Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. I'm Greg Matuszak, your liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio.
I'm Cliff Dunn, your Republican from Virginia.
I'm Rebecca Kushmider, your liberal Democrat from Kensington, Maryland.
I'm DJ McGuire, your Republican in exile from Suffolk, Virginia.
And I'm Kevin Kelton, a moderate Democrat from Los Angeles, California. And tonight we have a guest on the More Perfect Union, conservative attorney Helena Henry, who lives in Dallas, Texas. Helena, you want to tell us a little about yourself?
I am a registered Republican who is also, like DJ, in exile. Still consider myself a conservative and spent time working on the Hill for Senator Spector, working for Mayor Bloomberg, and now find myself in Texas.
Ah, beautiful Dallas.
The More Perfect Union can be heard on iTunes, iHeartRadio, YouTube, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, where you can also find host bios and some of our pithy commentary. Well, this past Tuesday, Donald Trump nominated Judge Neil Gorsuch to fill the vacancy left by Antonin Scalia, who died last February, and several Democrats are insisting on putting up a filibuster, not all of them, though. But for the most part, I think the impression that I got, you all may differently, is that this was probably the most Republican-friendly day that Donald Trump ever had.
Well, I'm going to agree, if just because it was actually a very good day. More or less the entire party's gotten behind him. Even the Democrats, although there's talk of a filibuster, the read I am getting is that there is not the stomach from the entire party to do it in the Senate. So I get a feeling I don't think there's going to be a filibuster, because Gorsuch is very qualified, very much within the mainstream of conservative thought, I would say.
The mainstream of conservative thought is far, far, far right, but that's okay.
Yeah, you know? He's actually judged to be right of Scalia.
Which is amazing.
I know most folks on the left like to tell themselves that, but the fact of the matter is, from what I've actually read, Gorsuch is considered to have a bit more flair than Scalia did with his opinions. He has respect from across a political spectrum, including...
He quoted Merrick Garland.
Including President Obama's former Solicitor General, former President Obama's Solicitor General, who has come out and said that Democrats should confirm him. The fact of the matter is, I think what Democrats need to realize is this is the reason why Donald Trump won the election. If Antonin Scalia were alive today, Hillary Clinton would be president. I genuinely believe that. This is the only reason Donald Trump won.
No, and, not the only reason.
No,
but
it's
not the only reason.
No, not the only reason. But please go on.
But the point I'm making is that if the Supreme Court is not an issue in 2020, and there's a lot of time between now and then, but if the Supreme Court is not an issue in 2020, if the assumption is that the court will be relatively stable in the 2020s, then Donald Trump will be at a severe disadvantage compared to where he was in 2016. This was the one thing he promised the Republican Party that he would do, and he did it.
Well, he promised a lot of things. He promised walls. He promised immigration. He promised a puppy. He did all sorts of crazy stuff. But
a unicorn.
Unicorn. Unicorn
dancing
smelling
girls.
All sorts of things. But let's be clear. There's not going to be a filibuster, because Democrats keep saying this whole thing, we're going to take the high road. And the voters are going to respect us because we're going to be nice about this. And, you know, when it comes on down the road, they're going to respect nice thoughts and feelings and how nice and high-roadish we are. Not so much the results that we get, no, but the high road.
So I would like to ask Helena, as a trained attorney, do you have any sense of where this man falls on the judicial spectrum, and why we have the perception, or we've been told by the media, that he's actually to the right of Scalia?
So I think that this has to do with a couple of things. First, where he has tended to fall on individual positions, but second, his view of the Constitution and the extent to which he has a textualist approach to the Constitution. That's probably what's informing that view. I do want to note two things. One, this pick, the Gorsuch pick, is the thing that Trump has done that has eased the consciences of those who voted for Trump. A lot of those who voted for Trump. This has allowed many people that I know to sleep at night. And the second thing is, I want to push back a bit on the notion that this will not be relevant in 2020. Because when you look at the ages of the justices on the Supreme Court, we've got at least two who are in their 80s. What Trump has done here is he has demonstrated, I'm doing the things I said I would do. I gave you the pick that I said I would give, and I'm going to do it again in 2020. So when we're looking at justices who are now in their mid-80s in 2020, you can rely on me to get the same kind of conservative in.
What makes you guys think that this pick is not going to turn out the Democratic base in 2020? Don't you think that there's
kind of a... Turned out anyway.
They are? Okay. Why weren't they this past year?
I'm Bernie Sanders, but don't get me started on that.
No. Yeah, well,
I will say you had enough flaws with the candidate, with the candidate, and I think there were some messaging issues that there were enough cases where Hillary was framed as not being interested in the economic stuff. Remember, Bill's "It's the Economy, Stupid." Bill pushed for her to focus more on the economy. And I think, quite frankly, you have a lot of voters out there for whom they would happily vote for, broad health care, blah, 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 but they don't want all of the other campaign baggage that got thrown in this year.
I think that you're underestimating the fact that a lot of Democrats thought that Donald Trump, and frankly, I fell into this too, I'll be honest with you, we thought that he was a liberal in conservative clothing. And a lot of Democrats didn't show up or voted third party because on some level they thought that, his Supreme Court picks won't be that bad. They didn't look at the list. They knew there was a list. They knew the Heritage Foundation had approved the list. But it wasn't really front page news. In fact, it got buried. And if that election were held today, I think you'd have a very different outcome. And I think that the liberals would turn out and she would have beaten him by 6 million votes. I can't prove it. It's just a theory. Let me tell you, this pick is galvanizing the left.
All right.
On day one. Had 3 million people turn out at those protests. They were galvanized on day one. I'm not sure how they're going to get more galvanized.
Okay.
It's going to be pretty galvanizing when the Ohio abortion decision makes it to the Supreme Court and we're relitigating Roe. That's going to be galvanizing. I'm just saying.
Now, talking about people turning out, this is the third weekend in a row that there have been nationwide protests against the Trump administration. During the week, there was also the Berkeley protest. Was that last weekend or was that during the week? Where there was some
February 1st. Yeah.
Yeah, it was during the week that it was the college Republicans at Berkeley, and who knew that there were college Republicans at Berkeley, had invited Milo Yiannopoulos. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
I honestly don't know how to say it.
When you talk about the college, the Republicans at Berkeley, you might as well just say both of them. Why don't you just
I heard one of them on NPR. Because that's the kind of Republicans they are. He was invited to speak, and I guess there was a student protest planned because Milo's repugnant, and Berkeley students like to protest. And then it was infiltrated by about 150, they're saying they're Black Bloc anarchist protesters, who showed up and started breaking windows and lighting off flares and creating an unholy mess. And the whole event had to be scrapped because they couldn't guarantee anyone's safety on campus. And it's turning into quite the free speech debate. My particular stance is, you could have moved it.
Am I the only one here who believes that the protesters who were masked and came with bricks in their hands were actually alt-right plants, possibly brought by Milo himself?
That's just you.
That's a conspiracy, and you have no proof.
I do have proof. What my proof is? I believe it.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, is this your alternate fact of the week?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And you know what? I think both sides can have alternate facts. It's not just the right that can have alternate facts.
The only reason I would agree with Kevin is, like Rebecca
There's
said,
only one.
Well, on this one, is Berkeley students like to protest. In fact, I think you can get a major in it.
Yeah, you can get a master's there.
I'm pretty sure there's a master's program in protesting there. They're good at it, and they're good at doing it without breaking stuff. They have protests there like every week. They know this is the line, this is where you do it.
There were protesters. There were left protesters there. But there was a small group of 100 to 150 that showed up in masks and were violent and were burning things. There's no proof that those are Berkeley students.
The rumors I'm hearing among the very small is that they're anarchists. They're from a movement known as Black Bloc that is engages in what my anarchist friend refers to as the smashy smashy.
I would submit to you that anybody that shows up in public wearing masks and throwing bricks and starting fires, by the very definition, they're anarchists. They don't have to be members of a group that call themselves anarchists.
Well, I just hope we get Grover Cleveland and Franz Ferdinand to safety if we have anarchists around again.
So if there's anything, Kevin, that supports your theory, if you look at what's happened to Milo since the Black Bloc or alt-right plans have escalated the tensions at Berkeley, is Milo has gone from being a sideshow to a central component of the national conversation. And this bodes very well for his Simon & Schuster book deal.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of my conspiracy theory. I would just want to say one other thing. What I love about this podcast is that when we came to this topic, the name Yiannopoulos was not a problem for anybody, but we struggle over Milo and Milo. Most people have no idea what his last name is. I keep seeing on Facebook Milo Y all over the place. But we knew Yiannopoulos. We just couldn't get the first name right.
I can't spell it.
The other thing I'll say about Milo Y is, remember, he got his start from getting kicked off Facebook. This is his
and Twitter.
Right. This is his bag. You know, I have a message and it may not be liked and it may not be popular, but the man is shutting me down and liberals are shutting me down. Oh, wait. Now it's being shut down and the bastion of liberalness, Berkeley. So to say this is happening is kind of a repeating thing. Boy Who Cried Wolf. Is that a stretch of the imagination? Well, no, and it shouldn't happen.
But he's more famous this week than he was last week. And I think it's part of my little conspiracy theory that I would not be surprised if he was involved in this. And this was the plan to become a cause celeb.
And the other problem here is what happened in Berkeley a couple of years ago, right? So Berkeley has a PR optics problem. And they're limited in what they can do to respond to the Black Bloc or alt-right plants because of the pepper spray in the face. So you're now left with a situation where Milo's the center of the conversation. It's out of control. The police aren't going to intervene. And things can escalate to the level that they have and get the headlines that they're getting.
Well, and part of the optics problem also, for me at least, is that they had a couple hundred of these guys, and the police didn't manage to bag any of them. They all got away. Right. Now, this might just be the fact that the East Bay police have turned into the Keystone Cops, but if you wanted to start talking about conspiracy theories, Kevin, that would ring a bell that, usually when something like this happens, they manage to grab a couple of them.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's what makes me think they are part of Black Bloc, because I think those folks actually are pretty good at evading arrest. Who knows if the alt-right is any good at that?
But the only two things that matter, there are only two things that matter. One, as much as Milo the Greek would love it to be otherwise, there can only be one Pim Fortune. Secondly, the left or the opposition needs to be very, very careful because they're coming dangerously close to setting Trump's Reichstag fire for him. This wasn't quite that, but it was really, really close. I mean, Hitler at least had to set his own Reichstag fire. Trump may have the luxury of letting other folks set it for him.
Now, while we're on the topic of campus protests,
and can we keep in mind that Milo, what are we calling this guy? This dude, he's a Breitbart guy. So he and Steve Bannon have more than a passing acquaintance. So maybe Kevin's right.
I know I am. While we're on the topic of campus protests. There was another reference to a campus protest from the 70s this week. A GOP official in Michigan talked about the protesters that are happening or the protests that are happening across the country and said something to the effect of maybe it's time for another Kent State, which I found to be about as in bad taste as anything could possibly be. He actually also went on to say one bullet stops a lot of thuggery. And there are so many things wrong in that phrase that I can't even begin to, enumerate them. Anybody else find that particularly offensive?
incredibly offensive. Because, I mean, the deaths at Kent State, those were college kids protesting against a war. You know, they were not wrong.
But even if they were wrong, for anybody to say it's time to start shooting protesters in the streets again, imagine if a Democrat had said this.
The problem here is, to what extent has this type of rhetoric become normalized because we have developed such thick calluses from Trump? Are we seeing sentiments that always existed, maybe were more latent and are coming to the surface just now? Or is it something that's new and being really pioneered and championed by him?
I would say it's a matter of platform. I think that, you know, these were things that would be said at the water cooler and would vanish into the air. Now you type them on Facebook in that same sort of expecting it to pass and be ephemeral. And, you know, suddenly you're headline news.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to jump in and point out that, yes, A, you're right, this is water cooler stuff that, thank you, Twitter, thank you, Facebook, et cetera, now leaks out to the public and we get these bursts of outrage for it. Second is, and this actually does spin back into the Berkeley thing, college campuses as a whole have gained a bit of an optics problem in general over the last couple of years. You know, I've lost count of how many commencement speakers I've had to pull out because some group of students said, we don't want them, blah, 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 we're going to protest. William and Mary, and this is going back 10, 15 years, every time Henry Kissinger, who was the school's chancellor, showed up, there was a massive protest. And at one point, the college president had to turn around and say, guys, have you had your fun? Okay, good. The police are escorting you out. The college president had to have them kicked out. So, yes, it's bad form. It's bad taste, etc. On the other hand, there is a lot of frustration, I think, that has built up over time at these protests. And did the Michigan comment come after the Berkeley incident?
I believe so.
It happened.
Yes,
I think so. It happened. It happened February 2nd.
Okay, yes, yeah, so it came afterwards.
Came afterwards.
I think that basically the Milo incident in San Francisco, at Berkeley, probably brought out it didn't bring out the best in the right, but it did bring out their frustration.
You know, I would say a little column A, a little column B. This is the same guy. By the way, let's call this guy out because his name is Dan Adamini, and he's actually the secretary for the Marquette County Republican Party. So he's the secretary. I'm assuming an elected official, and it's not like president. He doesn't lead. He probably takes notes or whatnot. Yeah.
He brings the donuts, makes sure the coffee started.
So about a month ago in January, Congressman John Lewis said, I don't see Trump as a legitimate president, he tweeted back, what's that? Too many blows to the head during protests? So,
Jesus.
And it's not so much that I think there's a lot to be said that, yes, we would see this as a water cooler, but this party knows this, has seen this repeatedly, and I think this group has accepted it. The follow-up to this is the Marquette County Democratic Party, of course, is PISSED, as my mother would say. And in response to that, the Marquette County Republican Party shut down their Facebook page and made it private. So they've just said, you know what, we don't want to hear it from you. So
the other thing I would notice is what has been forgotten in the midst of time is that Kent State was not only a tragedy and not only a horror, but it was actually politically damaging to the Ohio Republican Party. They lost the governorship 6 months later. They nearly lost a United States Senate seat that was supposed to fall right into their lap. And they took some hits. The party as a whole took some hits in the midterm elections that year. So it's not as if, I don't know what this fellow was thinking, but the notion that bullets silence protest movements in opposition, just it did not hold in 1970, and I doubt it would hold in 2017.
I mean, and one other thing I would say is I have to put the qualifier out there that, you know, in these committees, in each county, you tend to have an executive committee of 5 to 9 people, depending on the committee. And sometimes you get some real goofballs in there. And if this guy is the only guy willing to take the notes, you might not be able to find the votes. No, really.
No, I'm sure
he's right. He's right.
There's got to be another guy with a Bic pen. I mean,
well, no.
Yeah, but
I
it's
mean,
a question.
You can actually set a phone to record it. Somebody they can illuminate the whole position.
The question is there somebody actually willing to pay attention long enough to take all the notes down? And, I mean, yeah, that tends to be something. It's easier to find the crazies to do that.
Talking about people with short attention spans, the President of the United States signed an immigration – oh, no, excuse me. There was a judge in Washington State, I believe, that issued a restraining order against the president's travel ban this week. Do you guys think that this is going to hold up? Obviously, it's going to continue to weave its way through the courts, maybe get to the Supreme Court. There's no telling whether it's going to get there before or after Neil Gorsuch takes his seat on the court, assuming he's confirmed. But how do you guys think this is going to play out?
It may not even hold up till 6 p.m. Monday. I mean, right. there's already something scheduled that the restraining order could be reversed sometime tomorrow.
By
so the
who?
Ninth Circuit allowed for the parties to submit extra briefing, and their responses are due Monday. There's also a chance, it's small, but there's a chance that the Supreme Court doesn't take it up at all. So you have the 4-4 split, and you know, in traditional cases that aren't quite as high profile and perhaps not quite as urgent, the court will really take something up if there is a circuit split. But in the event that they don't get the numbers here, they may leave the Ninth Circuit decision alone, and that would be the standing law.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think there's a good chance that you do end up with a circuit split at the end of the day, because let's remember this is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that is hearing this. I think there's a decent chance that you could see, say, the First Circuit in Virginia out here turn around and issue
fourth
their own. I think there's a good chance that the Fourth Circuit Court out here in Virginia could turn around and issue a separate ruling that would support the immigration order, and you know we could get into this hilarious situation where you cannot come into the U.S. from the following countries unless you fly into LAX, SFO, or Seattle.
See, here's that's not hilarious. Question. We have a different view of hilarious, but okay, go on.
So already in Boston, there's a court that declined to extend an injunction that was granted. So you have the situation already where there's one court who has said, I'm going to let this lapse, and then you've got the deportation stays in Brooklyn and in Virginia, and then you have, of course, Seattle. So you're already in a position where there's not consistency throughout the district courts, but the consistent component is there is a party here, these government agencies, that has a standing federal court order saying you can't do X. So, you know, whether you can do it through LAX or through Logan, the Seattle decision covers that.
Here's what I'd like to ask everybody.
Well, as it stands, the Seattle decision has caused the Department of Homeland Security to completely stop enforcing any of the provisions of the executive memo at all. So, and you know, and everybody, I think everybody understood that this is potentially a very finite window, and there was kind of this call to arms in the social justice warrior community, of which I am a part, that was, you know, if you are waiting to get back into the United States, do it now, get on a plane, make it happen, because this window could close at any moment.
Here's what I want to ask everybody. Is there a chance the courts come down one way? They, you know, the last decision is that there's a stay, there's a restraining order. A court rules that the travel ban is not constitutional. And Trump convinces the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department to enforce the travel ban anyways. What is to stop him from doing that? Obviously, he could be held in contempt of court, but it's pretty doubtful that any, even a federal court, is going to hold the president in contempt. And he has the army. He has the police. So what happens if we get to a real constitutional crisis here?
Yeah, and this is where you hope that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell remember, essentially, that the foundation of the principles that they believe in and that I believe in are that the separation of powers and the checks and balances that are in our system are there for a reason, and that they denounce that sort of behavior.
as I understand the law, the president does actually have the authority to block immigration from people that he perceives to be a threat. It's a fairly broadly written allowance in the U.S. code. I read about that shortly after the election. Now, what I think is potentially going to happen, and I'm not a lawyer, so I might be blowing it out my ass right now. The travel ban,
like most lawyers.
Yes, agreed. Yes.
Not a lawyer for that matter. I think there are portions of the executive memo that will stand. I think what is going to be a little more complicated is the issue of people who have green cards, who have legal standing to be here already. And I think that's what's going to get toppled. But for folks who are applying for new visas, new green cards, new travel allowances, that is what's going to be.
Yes. And the 90-day bans, that's probably a component that might stand too. What I was going to say is that sort of defiance of the court wouldn't actually be entirely unprecedented. So if you look at the reaction that, you know, Andrew Jackson has had to the courts, let him enforce his own. Yeah, exactly. Lincoln, exactly. And even Thomas Jefferson. So I don't think Donald Trump is thinking about it this way, but there is a history in our country of executives rejecting the guidance of the court. But I don't know that we get there.
I would like a note for the record that we have had essentially three Trump critics, one Trump defender who's not really willing to defend this. Donald Trump has not actually had anyone defend him on this executive order, and he's already won the debate tonight, and I will tell you why. Because we have spent the last 5 to 10 minutes arguing about what is legal, what is illegal, what is constitutional, what is unconstitutional, and we have not spent any time discussing the actual policy. Donald Trump is winning the political debate on this issue because no one is willing to question him on the policy. This is bad policy, whether it's legal or not. It gives our enemies a how-to manual on how to infiltrate the country. It depends on a naivete regarding restriction and control that is the mirror image of what the left does on gun control all the time. And it is basically an easy, lazy way to pretend that he is protecting us when he won't do what we actually need to do, like create a democratic government in Syria that can be an alternative to Assad and ISIS, or building up and supporting the democratic government in Iraq. He's not willing to do either of those things, so he signs a piece of paper that pretends to do something, and when it gets challenged in the courts, everybody argues, is it legal? Is it illegal? Does he know the checks and balances? Is he a tyrant? And he is scoring points on the policy issue because hardly anyone I've seen is willing to step and say, wait a minute, this is bad policy. It will not protect us. It will not keep us safe. It will actually make things worse. No one has been talking about that since judges first put bans on it. Before judges put restraining orders on this thing, before judges moved to stop this thing, people argued the policy. And then it just seemed to stop as soon as a judge intervened. Everybody said, oh, well, the policy debate is over. No, the policy debate is never over. We should spend more time reminding the American people that this is bad policy.
You know what else is never over? The life of Frederick Douglass. Because apparently...
You know, he's getting a lot of attention lately.
He's getting a lot of attention. He's doing a great job.
He's doing a great job. He'll be more and more recognized as we go on.
He
more
was
and more.
A hero in the Bowling Green Massacre. Where's your sense of patriotism?
Pour one out for the Bowling Green Massacre, kids.
Helena, you want to bring our listeners up to speed on what we're talking about?
Sure. So as some of you may know, February is Black History Month, and Donald Trump gathered his favorite friends, Omarosa, Ben Carson, and some others, to discuss the importance of Black History Month. And in doing so, mentioned Frederick Douglass. He spoke about Frederick Douglass in the present tense. I believe, I don't have the exact quote, but something to the effect of he's someone who's...
He's doing a great job.
Does amazing things and is continuing to get noticed more and more. Sean Spicer later tried to clarify his comments and made it worse, frankly. made it more present tense than Trump's initial comments, which, you know. But I think the interesting thing here is, putting aside the pandering, it is tremendous to see the impact of ignorance. And I don't say that lightly. You know, we had a series of campaign promises that Trump would get the best and the brightest. But ignorance is something that can't be cured by getting the best and the brightest around you, right? And ignorance of of an individual who is a revered figure for African Americans is something that's unique, because the message that it conveys is, I actually don't care. I didn't bother to Wikipedia this person, you know, and figure out the years he lived in the 10 seconds before I chose to bring him up. And I don't pretend to speak for all African Americans in the country. I can barely speak for myself, but that's a Black Lives Matter problem, right? That's a problem with appropriate respect and reverence for people who have paved the way for other African Americans to have the roles and have the opportunities that they do in this country.
I have to say that as we try and try to bring on conservatives and Republicans who will not speak ill of Donald Trump, it's impossible.
Well, I will say this, since someone mentioned Bowling Green, and here's where I'll lose some friends. With Bowling Green, and to bring everyone up to speed, Kellyanne Conway, in an interview, was it Chuck Todd?
Yes.
Is it with Chuck Todd? Yeah.
Yes,
and Chuck Todd noted that, in fact, the Obama administration had prevented two Iraqis from coming or something to that effect. And these were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green massacre. In her defense, I believe it is plausible what she meant to say was Bowling Green plot.
Yes.
And she simply spoke. I believe that's plausible. Her explanation doesn't make sense, because then she comes out and she says, I meant to say, oh, terrorist, not massacre. But the word terrorist doesn't make sense in the sentence that she spoke. But the problem here is, even though I believe that's probably what happened, she really did misspeak. And then there's a sort of hysterical reaction to her comment. Because they've put forth a universe of alternative facts, she loses the benefit of the doubt. And I think that's the shame, right? That now we're concerned about false information and inciting hysteria over fake attacks. When I don't think that's, I don't think this was that calculated.
I think it is calculated. I think they're geniuses. I think that we are so wrapped up in Bowling Green Massacre, we're not really looking at like the terrible things they really are doing. And right now we just spent 10 minutes talking about Frederick Douglass and Bowling Green, which is, you know, pretty, oh gosh, they're bumbling, oh, jinkies. But they're doing horrible things with Betsy DeVos and foreign policy and crushing and taking names off dogs' rights and humane society lists. And they're doing horrible, evil stuff.
But you know what? It's not like those things aren't being discussed at all.
No,
I've spent most of the week dealing with Betsy DeVos stuff. Every group that I'm in is you know, making frantic calls on Betsy DeVos. It's just fun to talk about Kellyanne Conway sounding like a nitwit.
I know, but I think they actually, it's my conspiracy theory of the week.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Please follow us on Twitter at MPU Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover us as well. And if you enjoy edgy political debates and would like to be part of ours, join us on Facebook in our political discussion group, Open Fire. We're all there, and we type better than we talk. We'd love to see you there, too. Until next time, have a great week.
Who here types better than they talk?
Not me.
I do.
I do.
I don't believe that for a second, DJ.